From the BBC in London, this is Robin Lustig with NewsHour. 60 minutes of news, comment and analysis from around the world. In this edition, Iraq announces the immediate expulsion of all American members of the United Nations weapons inspection teams. As the crisis deepens, we have the first reaction from the UN and we ask what is likely to happen next. The US government warns its citizens abroad to be on their guard against possible attacks as a team of its agents arrive in Pakistan to join the investigation into the killing of four American oil company workers and their driver. Also in this edition of the programme, we debate whether the time has come for members of the British Parliament to modernise their procedures and abandon some of their odder traditions. But first, let's hear the news in detail from Sandy Walsh.
Iraq has ordered the immediate expulsion of all American monitors working in the United Nations weapons inspection teams. The move was announced after a meeting of the Revolutionary Command Council headed by President Saddam Hussein. With the details, here's Bob Simpson.
Though the timing of the Iraqi expulsion of the American weapons inspectors was perhaps unexpected, the deed itself wasn't. Both in Baghdad and at the UN in New York, the Iraqis had made it clear they weren't going to abide by the Security Council resolution. It's not yet clear just how soon the weapons inspectors will leave, setting out on the long drive across the desert to the Jordanian border. It'll probably be within the next 24 hours, and it'll mean an end to the weapons inspection program, and that in turn will lead to a further stalemate, unless the meeting between the Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz and the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan later today can produce a solution, but this seems unlikely.
The United States said the decision was unacceptable and would have grave consequences. Its ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, said that in singling out Americans, Iraq was pushing the issue of weapons inspections to the brink. The UN inspectors are in Iraq to ensure that Iraq has complied with UN resolutions to dismantle its weapons of mass destruction, the main condition for lifting economic sanctions against Baghdad. And we hope to hear more from Bob Simpson later. The US State Department has urged American citizens to postpone non-essential travel to Pakistan and warned Americans abroad to be on their guard. The warning comes after four American businessmen were shot dead in Karachi and follows the conviction in New York of a Pakistani for masterminding the bombing of the city's World Trade Center in 1993. That attack left six people dead and more than 1,000 injured. Phil Goodwin reports from Islamabad.
Pakistan's Foreign Minister Gaurav Ayub Khan says police investigations in Karachi have produced several possible clues to the identity of the gunman. And he said descriptions of three men who had stolen the car used by the gunman had been found. But America has little confidence in Pakistani investigations. In 1995, two American consulate staff were shot dead as they drove through Karachi, and Pakistan's inquiries so far have not yielded any results. Faced with an attack which has made headlines around the world and which has come a few days before the first scheduled visit to Pakistan by an American Secretary of State for over 13 years, Pakistan's government is trying to cooperate as fully as possible with the American authorities.
The Secretary General of the Arab League, Ismat Abdelmegoud, has joined several prominent Arab governments in boycotting a conference in Qatar this weekend aimed at promoting economic links between Arab states and Israel. The League said he was staying away because of the lack of progress in the Middle East peace process. Sharp exchanges are expected in talks today in London between British officials and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the Middle East peace process. The British Prime Minister Tony Blair and the Foreign Secretary Robin Cook will back the American call for a freeze on new Israeli building in disputed territory. They'll also stress the need for Israel to stick to its agreements with the Palestinians. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason has more details.
British officials say the message will be one of sharp concern at the deterioration in the peace process. It has to be got back on track. Britain holds the Israeli government mainly responsible for the deterioration. The change of approach under Mr. Netanyahu, the officials say, has made the Palestinians and Arab countries worry about the Israeli government's commitment to the peace process and to the 1993 interim agreement. Mr. Netanyahu has said he'll seek Britain's support for his proposal to accelerate the negotiations with the Palestinians and go straight to a final settlement. But British officials said it wasn't possible to get serious negotiations on that going unless you stuck to existing agreements. obligations to troop redeployments in the West Bank, for example, couldn't just be brushed aside.
China has revised its estimate of the number of people carrying the virus that can lead to the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS. The authorities now believe that between 150,000 and 200,000 people have HIV or AIDS, although only 7,000 are registered. Officials say there's an epidemic among intravenous drug users. Here's Duncan Hewitt in Beijing.
This latest estimate is a confirmation of the view of experts that HIV/AIDS is no longer limited to the southern and eastern coastal areas where it was first reported in the 1980s. At the same time, China has announced an HIV awareness campaign to coincide with World AIDS Day on December the 1st. AIDS specialists from Hong Kong and mainland China will spend a week travelling on the new Hong Kong to Beijing railway, giving information and advice to passengers. Foreign specialists working in Beijing say it's another sign that China is beginning to lift the taboos on discussion of AIDS, which the government used to see very much as a foreign problem.
BBC World Service. Now back to Robin Lustig.
The news that Iraq is ordering all American UN weapons inspectors to leave the country immediately seems likely to bring this latest crisis to some kind of climax. Certainly, the UN Security Council resolution, which was passed unanimously last night, seems to have done nothing to defuse the crisis. If anything, it has encouraged President Saddam Hussein to toughen his stance. A few moments ago, on the line from New York, the spokesman for the UN Weapons Inspection Team, Ewan Buchanan, gave me his reaction to the Baghdad announcement.
Well, it's clearly a defiance of the UN Security Council. I mean, they acted unanimously last night and passed a very strong resolution demanding that Iraq rescind its policy decisions of the 29th of October and also demanded that they cooperate fully and immediately without any conditions or restrictions with our inspection process. Well, we sent teams out again this morning, you know, in accordance with our mandate to try and inspect various sites in Iraq, and they were again blocked. This is a clear defiance by Iraq of the terms of the Security Council's resolutions.
Iraq now says that the Americans who are part of those inspection teams must leave the country immediately. Will they do so?
Well, that's something we have to sit here and consider this morning here in New York. Obviously, the day is very early for us at the moment. That's something we've got to do, look at immediately. But I understand the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq is calling on the Secretary General of the United Nations at 10 a.m. this morning. That's in about 2 hours' time from now. He may have some additional message or clarification to add as to what Baghdad means by immediately.
Is it possible that the Americans who are in Iraq at the moment may be in some personal danger as a result of what's been said today?
Well, I hope not. I mean, last night, the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, speaking here in New York, told the media that there was no threat and they were under no harm. So I hope that remains the case.
But a decision will have to be made in the coming hours, presumably, as to how these inspectors should react to what's been said.
Exactly, yes, and that's what we need to get on with this morning.
Ewan Buchanan of the UN Weapons Inspection Team on the line just a few moments ago from New York. Well, with me now here in the studio is our Middle East analyst, Roger Hardy. Roger, this does seem to put the crisis into a slightly more immediate context, doesn't it?
I think that's right. But at the same time, it's fairly predictable that Iraq has expelled the Americans, or at least is about to expel them. It had, after all, threatened to do so and then only suspended that threat to give Tariq Aziz a chance to try to get some kind of negotiation going at the UN. Now, that's clearly failed. So it's therefore fairly predictable that Iraq is taking this course of action.
What are the calculations going on in Baghdad, do you think? Is it being assumed there that these Americans will indeed leave and that Iraq will be seen to have scored a point? Or is it assumed that they won't leave and that there will be some kind of military reaction?
I guess they feel that the Americans will leave and that the Iraqis are rather disingenuously, I think, saying that they will continue to cooperate with the non-American weapons inspection teams. Now, I don't think anybody expects that to happen. I think Saddam Hussein has, in effect, stymied the whole weapons inspection program, and one can only assume that that's his main aim, and that he's ready to do that even at the cost of putting off the day when the main sanctions, the economic sanctions against Iraq, would be lifted. It's more important to him, it would appear, to stop the weapons inspection program in its tracks, and that's what he's done.
Does it look to Baghdad then, do you think, as if the choice facing them was either economic sanctions continuing with weapons inspection teams or economic sanctions continuing without them, and that's the option they've gone for?
I think that's right. I think although Saddam Hussein would ideally love to get sanctions off his back for the obvious reason that then the Iraqi economy can revive and he can be a big regional player again. I think that's one of his ambitions. It does look as if he has a more immediate concern. It does look strongly, suspiciously like the weapons inspectors were closing in, especially on his biological chemical weapons program, and that he feels he's got to have it. And one can only assume he feels a regional threat either from Iran or elsewhere that he can't afford to be without serious weapons, weapons that will be either a deterrent or an actual weapon in his hands.
Roger Hardy, thanks very much indeed. Well, obviously, what does happen next will depend very largely on decisions which are made in Washington, and they will depend at least in part on what the Clinton administration thinks that the American public will accept. Well, with me now also here in the studio is Barry Hillenbrandt, who is the London Bureau Chief of Time magazine. Barry, how is American public opinion regarding all this at the moment?
Well, I think there's probably a slight separation between public opinion and the editorial writers and the thinkers in Washington, but I think they will lead the way. I think that the main thing is that there's a sense in America that Saddam is the personification of evil. I mean, and it's coupled with chemical weapons, biological weapons, the total undemocratic nature of the regime, and that has given the administration a fair amount of support.
If then the administration decides that it does wish to take some form of military action, missile strikes or whatever it might be against Baghdad, they would be supported in that, would they?
I don't think you would have any problems in getting support on that in the U.S., certainly in Washington, and I think nationwide.
If it's possible now, I mean, they're only just waking up in Washington and New York now, but are they, during the course of the next few hours, going to take the view that that really is the only option available to them now, or are there still other options?
Well, I think they will obviously try to look at other options, but a little bit of stick right now in form of some sort of military action probably seems the likely outcome of this, in that this is what they're able to do. I mean, the range of options aren't very good. I mean, obviously going to the U.N., which they had done, again, is not going to work very far.
And yet it is true, is it not, that over the past several years, the Americans have from time to time taken limited missile action against Iraq. It doesn't seem to have made that much difference.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the options are limited, but they're not very attractive or very effective.
How interested are Americans in what's happening in Iraq now?
Well, I mean, insofar as Americans are interested in foreign news, I suspect this is the big story. And I think there is... It's a clear kind of story. It's a kind of story Americans and a kind of issue that Americans like. It's very black and white. Saddam, the evil dictator, and America trying to stick up for rights.
Would you expect some form of announcement out of Washington during the course of today?
I think the administration will have to act. It can't accept this. It tried to finesse it through the UN over the last three or four days. That clearly hasn't worked. So I think that they will be pushed. And the feelings that I've had in talking to people in Washington in the last few days is that that the military option is real. There are an awful lot of people heading off to the Nimitz.
Barry Hillenbrandt, thanks very much. You are listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Coming up next, we'll be hearing from China how health officials there are stepping up their campaigns on HIV and AIDS awareness. And we'll be reporting from India on claims that a huge new port project will endanger the survival of local tribespeople. I'm Robin Lustig in London. Reminder of the main headline, if you have just tuned in, Iraq is expelling all American members of the United Nations weapons inspection teams in direct defiance of a new United Nations resolution condemning its obstruction of their work. In a swift reaction, the United States has described the move as unacceptable. It's warned that it could have grave consequences. Thousands of people in Indonesia have been lining up to claim compensation for accounts in private banks which have been closed down. The government has promised that all personal accounts up to the value of $6,000 will be guaranteed. And so far it's reported that everyone has been able to get their money back. Well, on the line now from Jakarta is our correspondent Jonathan Head. Jonathan, if there's no problem getting the money back, why have the banks closed down?
Well, the money's been guaranteed by the government, and the fact that it's only been guaranteed up to a sum of around $6,000, that is really about all the government could have afforded. It's a huge sum. They put up something like $500 million to cover this. But there are, of course, a lot of other account holders in these banks, businesses and so on, who have considerably more, some greater sums of money. Some may have many tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. They won't be getting their money back, if at all, until the liquidation process goes through, and it's quite likely some of those may find themselves in serious financial trouble. So this is very much a measure for the small people and to try to avoid a mass panic.
So what is the background then to the closure of the banks?
Essentially, Indonesia's banking sector is oversaturated. There are 240 banks here, which is an absurdly large number for a relatively young economy. Also, the banking regulations, although they in themselves are reasonably good, have effectively been honoured in the breach. Politically well-connected people have simply avoided disclosing how they ran their banks, and in the boom times of the past few years, they've happily borrowed huge sums of money, lent it out to their own businesses. Now, with the currency crisis, they find themselves overextended. The 16 who have been liquidated are believed to be an absolute minimum. There are other banks in trouble.
And this is something that the IMF had wanted as part of its reform package, isn't it?
It was an absolute minimum. The IMF understood that the main thing they had to do to get Indonesia's economy healthy again, to get to the bottom of this lack of transparency and so on, was to get to the banking sector cleaned up. If the banking sector is in trouble, it means all businesses are in trouble. And in a sense, 16 was a good move. Some of the 16 banks themselves did have politically well-connected people, like the president's children, involved in them, so it sent the right signal, but many people believe further reforms have to follow.
Are people going to be worried, do you think, about the stability of the banking system if they see banks being closed down? I mean, is it likely to damage confidence in that way?
It certainly already has. A lot of people are very, very nervous about banks now. A lot of people did not expect their banks to be closed down. They were unsure why they were targeted. But I think the authorities made good by the way they handled today, realizing that the most important thing was to get down to the little people. They had a very well organized payout today. They had a very large number of state banks open for people to go and get their money. They treated them well. They offered cakes and coffee, and by and large, everyone was able to get their money. I think for the business community, there's a far more critical question, which is, will other banks be closed down? And will they then add to the number of businesses who can't get their money, who then go bankrupt? Bearing in mind there are a very large number of other businesses who are heavily indebted here, who are facing possible bankruptcy in the next few months. These are very critical months for Indonesia. The economy is a long way from being out of the woods yet.
Jonathan Head in Jakarta, thank you. Officials in China have raised their estimate of how many people are infected with the HIV virus, which can lead to AIDS. The new estimate is between 150,000 and 200,000, although the number of confirmed cases is still only 7,200. The government says the main reason for the spread of the virus is drugs use in the west of the country, and a new HIV awareness campaign is being planned to coincide with World AIDS Day next month. Well, on the line to Beijing, I asked Dr. Kingsley Ji, who represents the World Health Organization in China, how much is now being done?
I think there's a lot more awareness than, say, 4 or 5 years ago when we were just starting to report cases of HIV and AIDS in China. People were not very willing to talk about the use of condoms. Now people are much more aware of the importance of HIV. People will talk about condom use. They will admit that students have sex and are now developing programs directed at school children and university students and groups in the population who weren't really targets of specific health education in the past.
Is it your impression then that not only the amount of work that's being done has changed, but also the tone that is being adopted? Are the authorities now prepared really to be much more open about the role that sexual activity does play in the spread of the virus?
Yes, senior leaders in the health field are very willing to talk about sexual behaviour as being an important feature of the spread of HIV/AIDS.
I imagine it's always very difficult to gauge the effectiveness of campaigns of this kind, but do you believe that the message is getting through? Are the authorities managing to change patterns of behaviour in any way?
There's certainly a lot in the media now, a lot in newspapers. There are a lot of public awareness campaigns. There are displays in public parks, for example, in Beijing, where people can come and talk about AIDS. There's an increase in number of hotlines available in cities throughout China. What we hope is that this keeps ahead of the increase in the spread of the virus.
Would you then say in general terms that you are satisfied that the central authorities are doing everything that they ought to be doing in this particular field?
I don't think we can never be completely satisfied. It will spread. It's like any other country. Chinese have sex. The virus will spread in China, but we hope we can keep it within manageable levels.
Kingsley G of the World Health Organization on the line from Beijing. Well, with me now here in the studio is our former correspondent in Beijing, James Miles. James, it is clear from what Kingsley G was saying that there has been quite a marked change in official attitudes towards AIDS and HIV. How much of an issue is it in China now?
Well, it's not really that big a public issue, despite the government's efforts to publicise the dangers of AIDS. I think most ordinary people in China are still generally ignorant about the way AIDS is transmitted, and this is reflected in their treatment of those who have contracted the AIDS virus. There is still an attitude among ordinary people that these sufferers should be isolated, and I think that's one reason why AIDS victims are unwilling to come forward and be identified.
There have obviously been a great number of very profound social changes in China over the past decade or so. Do they in some way have an effect on the way in which a virus of this kind is transmitted?
Certainly a profound effect. There have been almost revolutionary changes in China in the last few years, whereas after the communists took over, prostitution was eradicated, drug abuse was eradicated. In the last 15, 20 years or so, these problems have resurfaced with a vengeance, and there are now many thousands of intravenous drug abusers, particularly on the borders with countries like Burma, the Golden Triangle, where heroin flows across relatively freely. There is also a significant gay community in China. Most of the AIDS sufferers now are people who are intravenous drug abusers. It has been much more problematic for the government to identify those in the gay community who might have contracted the HIV virus, simply because there is such a degree of social opposition to this phenomenon.
James Miles, thank you very much. In India, a British multinational is being accused of environmental destruction over plans to build what could be one of the world's largest ports. The development by P&O would be sited in what's known as an ecologically fragile area, one of only three in the whole country. Tehanu, 140 kilometres north of Bombay, is specially protected by the central government and by the Supreme Court. It's also home to one of India's tribal people who are under increasing threat from urbanisation. Martha Kearney now reports from India on the clash between the drive for economic prosperity and the needs of the environment.
Around 100 miles north of Bombay, a different world from modern India, marked by tribal music, thatched huts, forest and pristine beaches.
In the heart of a Wali village, I'm watching a celebration of the harvest. A local musician is playing the tarpa, which is a kind of horn made from a gourd. He's circled by women whose arms are linked, and they're tapping out a kind of rhythmic line dance. But there are those who believe that this kind of tradition won't be able to survive a huge development like the P&O port.
Martha, this is our projected development in Ward 1. I must stress here that this is an artist's impression.
At P&O's offices in Bombay, executive Nikhil Naik shows me plans for the port at Vardhan.
There is a tremendous need for more port facilities, and that is why there is a requirement for a port at Ward 1. The taluka must be allowed to develop as the rest of the country is developing. You cannot have one small part of the country not developing at all.
But the unique environment there means that P&O faces a bitter battle. Its forest, wetland and tribal population earned its special status as an ecologically fragile area, one of only three in the whole country, backed by the Supreme Court. The construction of the port would wipe out nearly 3 kilometres of protected coastline. The site would ultimately be developed into one of the biggest ports in the world. Environmentalist Nergis Irani fought to get Danu's special status.
It just kills me thinking about the fact that the P&O want to come here and our government is helping them to site the port here. They have no right. I mean, you can see it. You've been to Danu and you see how beautiful it is. I don't think anyone has a right to destroy an area like this.
At a harbour along the coast from the planned site, fishermen are fighting against the port, which they claim will destroy the catch of 2,000 boats.
Naveen. There'll be very few new jobs. Our jobs are for life. We fishermen have been working here for centuries. Generation after generation has had work. Each boat is like a small industry.
Inside a darkened hut, a holy man performs a sacrifice, slaughtering a chicken in an ancient pre-Hindu ritual. Whole villages of tribal people are fearful of the industrialization a port would bring. Two-thirds of Dani's population are Walis. Outside, a woman cooks a chapati made from wild cucumbers. These people have been self-sufficient for centuries, relying on the forest for food and shelter. Now they're worried that their way of life could change forever. Nashia Bimra sits on the village council.
I heard everybody's complaining that when it comes, it'll be trouble for everybody. And that's why we do not want it. When the big boat comes, it'll definitely create problems for farmers.
But as cranes unload containers night and day, Bombay's port is already overstretched, which is why the Maharashtra state government is driving forward the P&O plan. Despite Danu's environmental needs, Chief Minister Manohar Joshi boasts that the area could soon be positively teeming with industry.
As soon as the port starts, there will be an employment to the extent of 2,000 people. Direct employment. But indirect employment, we have presumed that there will be 15,000 people will be employed.
But where does that leave an ecologically fragile area? P&O has posted a mission statement on the internet proclaiming its support for sustainable development.
We think our development will be completely environmentally friendly. Actually, we have shifted to Ward 1 because of the environmental problems that could have been associated with other sites. And so we do not feel that even the spirit of the law will be violated by the proposed development at Ward 1.
Late into the night under the fireflies, Wali harvest dances continue around a tinny transistor. People here are now hoping central government will intervene. Campaigners have even appealed to British politicians to stop P&O. But against the combined weight of the state government, desperate for economic growth, and a powerful multinational, it seems an unequal battle.
That report from Martha Kearney. Business news now, and one of the world's top cigarette makers, BAT Industries, is believed to be on the verge of buying the motor racing team Tyrrell as part of a drive to promote its main brands all over the world. The money may be welcome for the racers at Tyrrell, but it is certain to provoke controversy. With more on that and the rest of the financial news, here's Roger Harvey.
The reported deal comes at a time when sponsorship of sport by cigarette companies is a hot topic. Not only here in Britain, where it's involving allegations of influence peddling, but also in the European Union as a whole. EU health ministers are preparing to remove cigarette advertisements from race circuits, racing cars and drivers' clothing. I asked Gordon Farker of BBC Sport whether a ban would work.
I suppose it's very difficult if they become the owners of the team to prevent their name and their being associated with the racing cars out on the track. I suppose they're being quite clever, but equally if the authorities are determined enough to reduce the amount of tobacco advertising and sponsorship that there is in Formula One, which is their aim long term, that they might also find a way of preventing them from doing it.
And whatever happens in Britain and in the EU, areas such as the Far East where tobacco sales are expected to grow most rapidly are not going to be affected by any kind of ban.
Not in the least. And look what happened when the British government said that we're going to introduce a blanket ban on tobacco promotion and sponsorship in sport. The Formula One teams that are largely based in Britain, at least two-thirds of them are, said, right, that's it, we'll up sticks. We'll go to the Far East, we'll run our races out there, and you won't get any of the other benefits, the associated economic benefits that go with having this huge multi-million dollar industry largely based in Britain. And it's a question of are they bluffing or not. I'm not so sure about that. But if the governments push it too far, then the bluff might well be called.
Well, BAT itself isn't actually saying a lot. It's neither confirming nor denying the reports in this morning's press. But it does say it'll make its decision known next month. News from the financial markets now. In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng Index finished 112 points up at 97.20. The Tokyo stock market continued depressed. The Nikkei was 6 points down, closing at 15,427. In London a few moments ago, the 100 share index was up 11 points at 47.31.5. The dollar's trading at 1.72 and 125 yen. The pound is at $1.70. And that's the finance, Robin.
Thank you, Roger. Coming up next, we'll have more on the latest developments in the crisis over UN weapons inspectors in Iraq. And we'll be reporting from Somalia on international relief efforts following the devastating floods in the south of the country. You're listening to the BBC from London. This is Robin Lustig with NewsHour. It's now 13:30 Greenwich Mean Time. Let's have a summary of the latest news from Sandy Walsh.
Iraq has ordered the immediate expulsion of all Americans working on United Nations weapons inspection teams. The United States described the move as unacceptable and said it would have grave consequences. In its first reaction, the UN condemned Iraq's action. Spokesman Ewan Buchanan.
It's clearly a defiance of the UN Security Council. I mean, they acted unanimously last night and passed a very strong resolution demanding that Iraq rescind its policy decisions of the 29th of October and also demanded that they cooperate fully and immediately without any conditions or restrictions with our inspection process.
A team of United States special agents has joined the investigation in Pakistan into the killing of four American oil executives in Karachi on Wednesday. Washington has put out a warning for all Americans abroad to be on their guard for possible attacks. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in London for talks with British and American government leaders. He's expected to face tough questioning over the stalled Middle East peace process. China has given new, much higher estimates of the number of its citizens infected with the virus that leads to AIDS. Beijing now believes that as many as 200,000 people may carry HIV, twice as many as previously thought. A court in Egypt has given a life sentence to the former director of a mental hospital for discharging a man who later attacked a German tourist bus in Cairo 2 months ago, killing 10 people. The doctor was convicted of negligence and corruption. The military prosecutor said he had taken bribes to release the man. Malaysia is to try using Russian rainmaking equipment to clear the haze which has covered parts of Southeast Asia for 2 months. The Malaysian authorities say the rain machine creates high winds which cause clouds and rain. They say they're confident the winds won't damage property or the environment, and the Russians say they'll only have to pay if the rain machine works. Robin.
Sandy, thanks very much indeed. Well, more now on the deepening crisis over the United Nations weapons inspectors in Iraq. On the line now from Amman in Jordan is our correspondent Bob Simpson. Bob, first of all, can you tell me any more about what exactly the Iraqis have said in this announcement?
Well, they issued a statement through their news agency, the Iraqi news agency, saying that the six Americans would be expelled with immediate effect. They didn't say what immediate effect meant. I suspect it means 24 hours. I've been thrown out of Iraq a couple of times, and it was always 24 hours on those occasions. So I suspect we'll be seeing them moving across the border, you know, within the next 48 hours, something like that.
Do you see a direct link between the terms of the resolution which was passed by the UN Security Council last night and what is being said by Baghdad today?
I see a direct link between the rather wet resolution that I think it was perceived as that was passed. I think Saddam was able to carry on with the policy that he'd adopted of defying the UN and, as far as, you know, in his eyes, the United States. And because the threat of military action by the UN had been removed, he felt that he could just go on and do exactly what he'd said he was going to do.
What is the feeling elsewhere in the region, Bob, about how this crisis is now likely to develop? Is it being assumed that some kind of stiff US or UN reaction is now on the cards?
I think, yes, it's accepted that it's on the cards, but it's desperately opposed. There's no Arab nation that is in support of it. I think mainly because Iraq is no longer felt to be a threat to its neighbours. It's not threatening the borders of Kuwait again. It's not threatening the Syrian border. It's not threatening anybody's borders. It's perceived here as a row between, really, Iraq and the United States, because the Iraqis have always blamed the United States for sanctions and for sanctions not being lifted. And people here are not desperately keen to get involved, and they're not keen for there to be military strikes against Iraq.
Bob Simpson in Amman, thanks very much indeed. Let's go now to Washington. Our correspondent there, Bridget Kendall, joins me from Washington. Bridget, I know it's still quite early there. The US has already said that this Announcement from Baghdad is totally unacceptable. It's warning of grave consequences. In Washington speak, what does grave consequences mean?
Well, it means exactly what it meant last week, which is that Saddam Hussein should watch out, but we're not telling you what we might do yet. And, of course, the underlying message of that is, we heard from the Security Council members yesterday, the United States might be prepared to launch unilateral military action, but that would mean splitting its alliance at the United Nations. So the US is, of course, in a very difficult position.
Over the next few hours, how is this likely to play out? Mr. Clinton presumably will need to consult with his senior advisers. Could we expect some kind of announcement very soon?
Possibly. There's an indication from the White House President Clinton is meeting his national security team today. Up till now, they've been meeting every day and reporting to him, I think, by phone. So if they have a fully-fledged meeting, that would be a chance to assess where they've got to now and should they take a change of direction. Personally, I would doubt that there would be a change of direction. So I think they would still place the ball in the UN's court at the moment. They're saying it's up to Ambassador Butler to decide, for example, what to do with the other weapons inspectors. And I would have thought they'd want to go back to the Security Council to say, look, you see, Saddam Hussein's defying our resolution. He won't comply, and he's throwing out the Americans, and take it step by step. What has been made clear in the numerous occasions that U.S. officials, top U.S. officials, have spoken about this is that if Saddam Hussein were to go ahead with his threat to shoot at and possibly damage U-2 flights, which possibly there may be another one soon, then all bets are off. Then one could expect there would be some sort of U.S. military retaliation. But a lot has changed since the last time the United States attacked Iraq. There's no U.S. election around the corner, so that President Clinton doesn't have to prove anything to a domestic audience. There's a shaky alliance at the United Nations that the United States is desperately concerned to maintain. And what's more, it's perfectly clear from everything President Clinton and his advisers say that their main aim is to get the weapons inspectors back in, and sending a few cruise missiles to Iraq may not help that at all.
Bridget Kendall in Washington, thank you. British members of Parliament will be discussing a subject very close to their hearts later today. Themselves and how they go about their business. The Labour government wants them to consider if the time has now come to abandon some of their most cherished traditions, all those hear hears and right honourable gentlemen and so on. From Westminster, our political correspondent Tim Franks now reports on what that might mean for an institution that still likes to think of itself as the birthplace of parliamentary democracy.
This is the sound of a Labour minister being on message.
This bill is a further step in our determination to modernise the British economy.
Alistair Darling, a finance minister, talking in Parliament this week. It doesn't really matter what he was talking about. It happened to be the Bank of England. The key word was modernise. Labour is on a mission to modernise, and Parliament is its latest would-be convert. Now is a good time. There's a huge number of brand new MPs not versed in parliamentary tradition. Their newness was there for all to hear when Tony Blair made one of his first appearances as Prime Minister in Parliament. I'm afraid you simply do not clap in Parliament. If you want to show your approval, you do it the way Conservative MPs showed that same day with their own leader. The key words in this case are hear, hear. One of the members of the new Modernisation Committee, which has produced the report at the heart of today's debate, is Phyllis Starkey. She's a new MP for the governing Labour Party, with first-hand, recent experience of just how mystifying Parliament can be.
It's extremely difficult. I mean, there are some of the older MPs who take the trouble to try and explain it to new MPs, but not very many. And frankly, I think most of us, for the first few months, just couldn't understand what was going on.
The Modernisation Committee's report emphasises, as much as anything, the importance of involving ordinary backbench MPs in the legislative process. Everybody seems to think that's a good idea, but the reality may be a little different. In a recent survey, fewer than 1 in 10 MPs said that holding the government to account was top of their priorities. And the weekly session of
questions to the Prime Minister
on the governing side, at least, seems only to be a cue for MPs to ask the Prime Minister if he's aware that he's doing a splendid job. The report also turns its attention to what the legislative process means for the general public. You can picture the faces in the visitors' gallery listening to some of the action from last Tuesday.
Regulation of wet bags bill.
Second reading what day?
6th of February, Madam Speaker.
6th of February, thank you, Mr. Thomas. Clerk will now proceed to read the orders of the day.
One option is to make explanatory guides to legislation available on the internet. Another, which may be explored later, is to change the very language MPs use to address each other. A quick guide first. Only the Speaker can use a member's name. Otherwise, the address for an MP is...
The Honourable Member.
If they're a member of the High-Flown Privy Council, they're...
The Right Honourable Member.
If they're also a lawyer, they're...
The Honourable and Learned Member.
A member of the Armed Forces is...
The Honourable and Gallant Member.
And heaven forbid they should be a legally expert soldier or...
The Honourable, Learned and Gallant Member.
But Nicholas Winterton, an opposition Conservative MP on the Modernisation Committee, doesn't like the idea of changing this piece of parliamentary tradition.
No, I mean, I think that we are honourable members, and it gives a status to debate that shows respect across the chamber, although sometimes perhaps that respect is not felt, Speaker, to those who perhaps are intervening, or members to members across the House of Commons. But I believe it does give a certain status to debates, and I would myself be very reluctant to see change.
Where there is consensus on the Modernisation Committee is on the need for, well, consensus. The report calls for an end to the mindset, which means governments try and ram through their legislation as quickly as possible, while oppositions do their best to block and delay. There should be room for cooperation wherever possible, says the report. The intention may be laudable, but experience has suggested otherwise.
Come on, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Hughes, spit it out. Come on.
The truth is that MPs enjoy nothing more than the opportunity to punch holes in the other side, as poor Mr. Hughes of the Liberal Democrats found out.
Order, oh, order. There is no point in waiting for silence. The Honourable Gentleman isn't going to get silence. Produce your voice, Mr. Hughes.
Nicholas Winterton from the Conservatives agrees that Parliament should evolve, but it shouldn't reject the tradition that's made it the template for so many other democracies. Phyllis Starkey, the new member of the New Labour Party, would go further. She says that MPs shouldn't be seduced by the mystique.
The reality is that the way in which Parliament operates at the moment does not have hundreds of years of tradition behind it. Very much of the current way in which Parliament operates has only been happening that way for 30, 50 years. It has changed in the past, and it clearly needs to continue to change as society is changing.
The House of Commons is today's target for Labour's modernising beam, but the range of Labour's project extends across Parliament, indeed across the country. 6 months into the administration, the government's ambitions are still set high.
Tim Franks in Westminster. Well, I've been discussing some of those ideas with the right-wing political journalist Boris Johnson, who stood for Parliament as a Conservative at the last general election, and Mark Leonard of the left-of-centre think tank Demos, which is close to the Labour Party. I asked Boris Johnson if he sees any point in keeping some of the British Parliament's rather odd traditions.
Well, actually, I think if you study some of these traditions a bit more carefully, you can see the logic behind them. For instance, putting questions to the Prime Minister prevents members from launching into a great harangue in the form of a statement, obliges them to keep it short, it takes a lot of the polemic out of it, and it keeps it civilised. And the other convention, which is continually addressing people as honourable members and all that sort of jazz, I think there's a certain point in that, because, it stops the direct you harangue and shouting match. And so I think there is a certain logic in some of these things, which I'm sure some of these Labour MPs, these new Labour MPs, once they've been around for a little bit, will start to appreciate, as older Labour MPs clearly do.
Mark Leonard, it may sound odd to people, these rather archaic forms of address, but if you compare what happens in the House of Commons to what happens in parliaments elsewhere in the world, at least here in London, they tend not to hit each other.
I don't think they hit each other anywhere, to be honest. I think the reason why we need to reform our parliament is... because, A, it's making a farce of our democracy. It's making it a laughingstock across the world and incredibly difficult for anyone, let alone abroad, to understand, but certainly not in this country either. But also because it's, frankly, not very effective. It's not really asserting any accountability on our executive, and we're living with outdated procedures which have got nothing to do with the modern world.
British Parliament, the House of Commons, is watched avidly coast to coast in the United States. It's watched across Europe when it appears on the BBC. Whenever I was working in Brussels, as I did for 5 years, I found people who are immensely respectful and appreciative of the fact that the Prime Minister has to go and give an account of himself before the elected members of Parliament, which is a very, very rare thing on the continent. And the extraordinary thing is that Labour has been able to get away with neutering Prime Minister's question time, or greatly reducing it, and having only a half-hour session every week rather than on Tuesdays and Thursdays, as the Conservatives always did. I think it's quite the contrary. Our parliamentary system is incredibly healthy and widely respected across the world.
Mark Leonard, tradition obviously can't be set in stone, but there is some force to the argument, isn't there, that traditions do form a valuable sort of bedrock on which other things can be built. If you throw it all away, then you have a rather unstable institution.
Absolutely, but traditions are things which grow and which live if they're going to make sense, which, as Prince Charles said quite recently, if they are simply something which acts as a prison for you and which stops you from evolving, then you have to get rid of them. And the fact is that, as Boris said, we are watched across the world, but it's more as a comedy channel than anything else. I think the fact that MPs stroll out of bed and start work around lunchtime and carry on till people are fast asleep across the country is probably to cope with the time zone, so that people who do live on the east and west coast of America can watch it, because it certainly makes more sense for them than it does for us. I think things like Parliament being opened by some bloke in a wig and tights and people wearing top hats and shouting "I spy strangers" really add very little to our democratic process. They just make it difficult for ordinary people to understand and make us a laughingstock across the world.
Boris Johnson, just take on that point about ordinary British voters who put these people into Parliament to do a job of work. What they see too often is people speaking a language they barely understand and observing traditions which seem to have no point.
Of course, there are lots of parliamentary rituals that appear arcane, curious, funny. As it happens, I don't think people do often watch the I Spy Strangers stuff, and they don't normally watch the opening of Parliament. These are essentially harmless bits of flummery. Of course, you can abolish them if you want to. Just throw them out of the window. I don't think it would necessarily improve the standing of MPs in the eyes of the public. I think people like to see a strong adversarial system of parliamentary democracy. And I think if we did turn in to some stupefying Scandinavian round table sort of touchy-feely seminar, which is, I'm sure, what Mark Leonard would ideally like to produce, where everybody sits in a great sort of European Parliament style hemicycle, says how wonderful everybody else's speeches are, nobody would watch Parliament. The interest in Parliament would fall away altogether, and our democracy would be so much impoverished.
Mark Leonard, let's expand this argument out just for a moment away from Westminster solely. Is this, as far as you can see, a government now in the United Kingdom which is determined to smash tradition right across a whole spectrum of activity?
Well, I hope it's not about smashing tradition. I hope it's about trying to come up with some balance between what we want to take from the past, what's good about the past, and also looking at the reality of Britain today and trying to get these two to mould together, and so that we can look forward and build institutions which are fit for a modern age. It's not about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's just stopping these traditions from acting as a prison and allowing them to be something that we can live within, that we use to reinvigorate ourselves and constantly reinvent, like all useful traditions.
Mark Leonard of the think tank Demos with Boris Johnson of the Daily Telegraph. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig. This is NewsHour. A reminder of the main headline. Iraq is expelling all American members of the United Nations weapons inspection teams in direct defiance of a new United Nations resolution condemning its obstruction of their work. The United States has described the move as unacceptable, and it's warned that it could have grave consequences. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has arrived in London today for a visit which will see him once again come under pressure to freeze his government's programme on settlement building. He'll hear the message from the British Prime Minister Tony Blair and from the US Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who he'll be meeting here tomorrow. He's also likely to hear the same message from at least some of Britain's Jewish community, who are deeply divided over their attitude to the current Israeli government stance on the peace process. Well, with me now here in the studio is Jerry Lewis, who is the correspondent in London for Israel Radio. Jerry, how divided, in fact, are Britain's Jews on all this?
pretty well divided. It's almost like the Jewish community, the Israeli community in Israel. They're completely divided. The elections last year showed virtually half voted for Netanyahu, the other half voted for Peres. We have the same problem in this community. And in tomorrow's Jewish Chronicle, there'll be adverts from both sides of the fence. Herut have put in an advert. They're allied to the Likud right-wing movement, supporting Netanyahu, asking him to stiffen his resolve. And there's the Peace Now faction, who tend to be linked with the Israeli Labour Party.
How important is any of this to Mr. Netanyahu himself? Does it actually matter?
He seems to ride roughshod over any criticism. He has this wonderful Houdini effect. He can get out of any diplomatic difference, any political problem he's got, any political situation. He's managed to ride out of them each time. But this one is very deep-seated. And there are a large number of people in this Anglo-Jewish community who give substantial monies to help Israel, to help the settlement of people coming into Israel. And they're going to say, some of them are actually saying, we're not going to stand any more of his policies. Some of them have actually said, we're not going to give any more money towards Israel. And some of them have turned down the opportunity to attend a major dinner tonight.
Is it, in fact, the settlement building programme and the effect that that has on the peace process which has led to this disaffection, if that's what it is, or is there more to it?
I think there's even more to it. There are two subsidiary issues. The main one is over not only the settlements, but his whole attitude towards the peace process, the fact that he doesn't want to have a Palestinian state. His coalition partners won't allow him to talk about a Palestinian state. He knows that he has got opposition to whatever he wants to say within his own coalition, even within his own cabinet. He feels that he's got a problem to overcome. He doesn't know how to overcome it. And there are people in this community, in the Jewish community in Britain and in America, who feel that he is negative towards the peace process. He's not carrying on the Rabin program, the Oslo Accords. The other major issue is the conversion issue. There's a law, a very controversial law, going through the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli Parliament at the moment, and that will seek to restrict the conversion activities of the reform movement, those who are less orthodox. That's going to cause major problems when he goes to America this coming weekend.
You talk about the financial contributions which members of the Anglo-Jewish community make to Israel. They also, of course, in the past, have lent it very valuable political support. Is that now in doubt as well? Will they, in fact, no longer be lobbying on Israel's behalf, perhaps in the way that they used to do?
I haven't heard any people backing out of the lobbying activities. They've got in Tony Blair, a prime minister who's very committed to Israel. He went to Israel way before he was elected the leader of the party. He's been to the Labour Friends of Israel functions at the party conferences each year. He's addressing a Labour Friends of Israel lunch in a few weeks' time. He's very committed to the whole concept of Israel, but even he is finding it difficult to try and at bat for Israel, if I can put it that way. And when Britain takes over the presidency of the European Union in a few weeks' time, on the 1st of January, he's going to find it increasingly difficult to hold some of his European partners in the same area.
It's not going to be an easy visit then for Mr. Netanyahu,
I think
it?
Not, and he knows that. He's prepared for that. He believes he's got a peace plan which can work. That's going to the final status negotiations. What's worrying him now is the press reports coming out today about Arafat's health. If there are going to be serious problems with the health issue, he's not going to know who to negotiate with in the future.
Jerry Lewis, thanks very much indeed. It's time now for the sports news. Here's Russell Fuller.
China's football team say they are overwhelmed by remorse and self-scolding for failing to qualify for next year's World Cup finals in France. They've issued a public apology asking for forgiveness following their disappointing performances in the Asian qualifying tournament. They finished third in their group behind Saudi Arabia and Iran, but there had been great expectation among the Chinese people that the team would reach the finals for the first time. Duncan Hewitt has sent this report from Beijing.
In recent years, soccer has become big business in China, with a nationwide professional league and its own local stars, some of whom are reported to be millionaires. So Chinese soccer fans could hardly believe it when their heroes were beaten 3-2 at home by Qatar. Many saw it as a moment of national humiliation for a country whose population is more than 3,000 times larger than that of the tiny Gulf state. On Wednesday, China did manage to win its last group match at home to Kuwait. But that wasn't enough to satisfy the fans, many of whom booed throughout and cheered the visitors. The Chinese players have clearly been affected by the public anger. According to the official Chinese news agency, a letter issued at the team's headquarters said that the squad wanted to say a sincere sorry to everyone. The letter said the players vowed to wipe away the tears and try again to catch up with the region's soccer powers. But China's football-crazy millions may take a long time to forgive them.
And staying with the World Cup, most countries wait until they've qualified for the finals before composing a musical tribute to their chances. Not Jamaica, though, who need a point against Mexico on Sunday to make sure of their place in France next year. A calypso singer called Michael Olivier has composed a song called, originally, Road to France, which will be sung during the half-time interval on Sunday. Jamaica are hoping to become the first English-speaking Caribbean country to play in the World Cup finals, and I'm sure the single and video, which were released at the weekend, are now available from all good Caribbean record stores. Finally, cricket, and Bangladesh will, after all, tour New Zealand, as a misunderstanding over their visas has been sorted out. Even though the New Zealand board formally invited the team, their High Commission in Delhi refused entry to three of the touring party. No reason was given, but the problem will now be solved in time for the three to join the party early next week.
Russell, thank you. Human rights activists, government officials and industry representatives are gathering at a UN-sponsored conference in Geneva this week, trying to decide what to do about the increased presence of racist hate groups in cyberspace. It isn't the first attempt to battle racism on the internet, and it won't be the last. But as our Geneva correspondent Owen Bennett-Jones reports, there aren't many options open for the people who want to ban racism from the internet.
Human rights groups were among the first to see the potential of the internet. Even the most repressive governments have found it difficult to control the free flow of information. But where human rights activists have led, racists and white supremacists have followed. Deborah Guzman is the executive director of the US-based Human Rights Information Network.
There are guides on how to kill people. There are games you can play that tell you how to hang black people. They're very sophisticated, they're very smart, they know the laws of their country. They also know which other countries have very permissive laws. That's one of the reasons you'll find a lot of hate sites based in the USA. For instance, a lot of German hate sites are located in the USA because that particular freedom to that kind of speech is guaranteed under the First Amendment, where it is not guaranteed in other countries around the world.
This is the David Duke International Internet Radio broadcast. In response to my last broadcast, I received a number of letters, both by email and regular post.
The website run by former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard and would-be U.S. Senator David Duke gives an example, by no means the most rabid, of the kind of material that's now on the net.
America was created of, by, and for white Europeans. When applied to the black race, whose natural talents and temperaments are not the same as ours, the systems do not function properly.
Other sites carry everything from violently anti-Semitic tracts to dating agencies for Aryans. But should this kind of material be banned? Some believe that however distasteful the websites may be, freedom of speech should be protected. Tracy Cohen from Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg is one of those attending the UN conference.
We need to revisit the commitment to freedom of expression and why we value it so much. Coming from a country where censorship was such a predominant way of life for many years in South Africa, it's revisiting the slippery slope argument. And for us, it's if you have censorship in one aspect of speech, it can overlap and go into other aspects of speech. And the context is all important. There's a very fine line between what is racist speech and what is political speech. You will often find that good political speech is being interpreted as racist and will thus also be censored.
Most racist material on the internet originates in the United States. But just because the US is so protective of free expression, should other countries be obliged to take a similar approach? Aga Shahi is a former Pakistani foreign minister and now a member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination.
The whole idea of trying to impose restraint or curbs or outlaw racist propaganda on the internet can fall to the ground because of the fact that some countries have absolute freedom of speech. In this, they go far beyond the requirements of international law because international law does recognize limitations to freedom of expression. Dissemination of propaganda is no longer a matter of holding an opinion, but it goes to become, it's a kind of behavior. The moment you disseminate, you're acting. And so it is outlawed under the Convention Against Racial Discrimination.
The problem for those who want controls is that while the US has signed the convention to eliminate racial discrimination, it added a reservation ruling out any legislation incompatible with the US Constitution and, by extension, the absolute right to free speech. And the technology underlying the internet means that for as long as one major player like the US refuses to go along with controls, then racist material will continue to be published on the net and to be available worldwide.
Owen Bennett-Jones reporting from Geneva. That's all for now. So, for now, from me, Robin Lustig, in London, and from everyone on the NewsHour team, bye-bye.